Judiciary Committee to order. Good afternoon, everybody. It's 1:31, this is the Senate Judiciary Committee. With us is Senator Kelly, Senator Costello, Senator Coghill, Chairman. My expectation is other members will join us as we go along. But I wanted to go ahead and start with some of the confirmation hearings. What we have is the Alaska Police Standards Council today, and I've got a couple online that I'd like to go ahead and give their testimony for the Police Standards Council. Is there anything else that you want to start with, questions or anything? We'll open it up for questions, knowing that their time is valuable. Even though I started late, I'm trying to catch up with everybody. So we do have Sergeant Larry Nicholson and Chief Justin Dahl online. Do either of you have a time constraint at this point?
This is Sergeant Nicholson. Yes, sir. I'm all yours.
All right. Mr. Dahl is that as well?
This is Justin Dahl with APD, and I'm actually doing pretty good this afternoon, too. So.
All right. So we're just going to start with Sergeant Nicholson, and put yourself on the record, Sergeant, and give us your testimony, why you would like to be on the Police Standards Council and be available for questions. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, sir. So, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Shane Nicholson, Larry Shane Nicholson, Sergeant with the Alaska Wildlife Troopers currently. I've been law enforcement with the Alaska State Troopers and for the last 4 years, Alaska Wildlife Troopers, coming up on 19 years now. I've been fortunate enough to be stationed all around the state, essentially from the Kenai Peninsula interior. I've been southeast Alaska, where I was stationed in Ketchikan, and then 4 years at the Public Safety Training Academy as a staff instructor, and then for 2 years as the deputy commander there. Currently, I hold a position as the post supervisor and sergeant for Kodiak Post as the Alaska Wildlife Trooper Sergeant. I've been very fortunate in my career to attend multiple trainings throughout the country and within the state, and also to put on a multitude of trainings to municipal and state organizations. The reason why I wanted to be part of the Alaska Police Standards Council was from my experience in law enforcement. I thought that my experiences and insight would be beneficial to the community. And I also want to help keep the standard with training, with the curriculum that are out there. And so that doesn't falter. So I just hope to be a part of that and be an asset on the committee.
Sergeant Nicholson, thank you very much. Questions at this point? Sergeant, just from one from me, but first of all, thanks for your continued service. Have you had a chance to attend or be a part of a council meeting at this point?
No, sir.
Okay. You bring probably that unique perspective for the wildlife troopers. Are there things that you think especially need to be addressed coming from your position?
At this time, until I actually get onto a council, sir, I'm open ears and open minds, and once I see how the committee is run and the direction that the committee has been going or is planning on going, then I may have some insight, sir. But at this point, like I said, I'm all ears and open mind. Just wanted to be a benefit to the committee.
Thank you very much. Just to let you know, we've been joined by Senator Schauer. Senator Schauer, we have Sergeant Larry Nicholson online, who is a wildlife trooper and is an appointee to the Alaska Police Standards Council. So if there's no further question, then I'll move on. With deepest gratitude, Sergeant, and We'll look forward to seeing how that works out for you, and thank you for being willing to serve.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Sergeant. And then Chief Dahl, you bring a world of experience with you. Put yourself on the record and give us your input on this.
Thank you, sir. This is Justin Dahl, Chief of Police with the Anchorage Police Department. And I'm honored to be asked to serve on the Alaska Police Standards Council. I have been to a few meetings. I think that it's really important for senior members of law enforcement to step forward and serve to help maintain the ethical and moral standards that we've all come to enjoy and expect from our Alaska law enforcement officers, and I think the Alaska Police Standards Council is an important part of that. I believe that you all have a copy of my resume, so I won't bore anybody with that unless somebody wants to hear about it. I've been with APD for almost 22 years, and I'm happy to answer any questions or dig into my background, training, and experience with APD if anybody's interested.
Chief Dahl, thank you very much. Is there questions at this point? I do have one. You've had many years of experience. That means you've seen many people coming and going, the standard has been reasonably high in Alaska. Do we match the standards of those who generally would come for an employment in Alaska, especially in your city?
Well, I think so. I actually think that Anchorage PD standard is a little different and maybe a little higher than the general template set out by Alaska Police Standards Council. But I also recognize some of the unique challenges that come from recruiting to, law enforcement agencies in rural Alaska. And I think it's going to be important as we go forward to maintain a balance and ensure that we're having qualified law enforcement candidates all over the state that communities can trust, but also make sure that the window in the standards is wide enough that those smaller rural agencies can adequately meet their recruiting goals. And I know from talking with chiefs around the state that that's a real challenge. And so I think that that's important for the council to balance those two things together to make sure that we're not lowering those standards, but we're also encouraging people to apply that are qualified for jobs in rural Alaska.
Chief, do you find that our standards at this point are sufficient for those who either have a significant failing in their life or turn out to be bad actors? Do you think that our system is clean enough to be able to bring that to light and deal with it appropriately?
I do. I think that the current Alaska Police standards that the council has established are pretty good. I think that they do generally reveal those issues. I think we all know that when we're dealing with people, you're never going to have a perfect system, and occasionally somebody is going to get hired by an agency, and then we're going to find out either through additional experience with that person or further bad acts that maybe they're not a good fit. But I think generally speaking, Alaska has good standards for its law enforcement officers. Those standards are being maintained, and the council has generally done a pretty good job of that.
Thank you. Those are the questions I had. Any other further questions? Senator Schauer has a question for you, Chief.
Thanks, Chief. I just came from two town halls this past weekend up in the Mat-Su, and a question that was asked by a number of citizens during both of those town halls related to basically citizen patrol groups, and with the crime rate as it has increased so dramatically in the last few years, do you have any thoughts on the partnership between both local law enforcement as well as the state troopers and how we might do a better job of using the eyes and ears of the citizens and working with them as opposed to perhaps either not at all or maybe even telling them we don't want their help? So just curious what your thoughts are on that.
Sure. To the senator, through the chair, I'm happy to address that. I think in Anchorage, we have a really good relationship with a variety of neighborhood patrols. Anchorage PD encourages any neighborhood group or other organization that wants to form a community patrol. We have a variety of material that we can give them to kind of help them get started. And even we have some specially trained officers with our community policing team that will go out and meet with neighborhood groups and basically give them advice. We don't give them legal advice, and we don't give them what you might think of as like use of force advice or anything like that. The advice that we typically give is, here's the best way to interact with APD. If you're patrolling your neighborhood or just happen to be in your neighborhood and you see something that doesn't look right to you, this is what you can expect from patrol when they respond. This is the best way to communicate with dispatch. Just so those people that are eyes and ears on the ground and can relay information to law enforcement are doing it in the most efficient way that's the most easily digestible by the patrol force. And so we're always happy to do that. We do that on a regular basis. And typically when I meet with community groups, I encourage them to do that because nobody knows what looks or what is right or wrong in a neighborhood better than the people that live there. If you live in your neighborhood, for example, on my street, if I see somebody that I don't recognize, I kind of live in the middle of nowhere, and so I'm immediately wondering who that person is. And I think anywhere that you live, that's going to be the case. So having folks in neighborhoods communicate with each other and communicate effectively with the police department, I think, is critical. And APD encourages that, and we're happy to share that model of how we do it with anybody else. And I'd throw out there also that we have right now a great partnership with Alaska State Troopers, and the information sharing and the collaborative working is the best that I've seen in the 22 years that I've been at APD.
Any other questions at this point? Chief Dahl, thank you for taking time to come to the committee, taking time to work with the Police Standards Council. I know you're going to bring some real good, added benefit all along the way. And then for those of us who get to watch how Anchorage goes, we get to see both the news and the practical outplay of every day's activity. You have our greatest respect, and please let your troops know that notwithstanding our political debates, there's a great appreciation for the blue that happened every day to stand up for us. So thank you, and pass it on, please.
Yeah, thank you, sir. I will be happy to do that, and thank you very much for your time today.
All right, thank you. We're going to go then to David Knapp, who is with the Department of Corrections in Palmer. David also is going to be on the Police Standards Council, appointed to it, and we get to hear his perspective. So, Mr. Knapp.
Hi, my name is David Knapp. I'm a staff sergeant with the Department of Corrections. I've been with Corrections 13 years. I started down in Seward at Spring Creek Correctional Center. I've also worked at Anchorage Correctional Complex. Went back to Seward after doing 3 years there, and then I promoted into MATSU pretrial, worked there for a few years, and then I was offered a position as our security threat group coordinator, which means I basically run a gang unit of one myself. what I do is I identify and monitor the gangs in our system as well as their members. It's a very unique position, and I think I'll bring a perspective to the council as a basically a frontline correctional officer that I don't believe the council's had in a while or if ever. I've also worked as a field training officer, so I've done quite a bit of training for COs. One thing I'd like to see is correctional officer training to kind of evolve and adapt with the changing offenders that we're having now, and so that we can stay ahead of the, ahead of the game. And that's it. I'm very, very honored to be selected out of over 900 correctional officers for this position, and I'm really looking forward to it.
David, thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Knapp? I have a couple of questions. First of all, I think you do bring an interesting perspective, and on a different vein, one of the things we hear about from our part of the discussion here in the legislature is that our jails are porous and that drugs can get in. And do you feel that there is sufficient safeguards to either highlight the bad actors or to even show that it's not necessarily the corrections officers that are at fault? But we do hear that from this level. What is your perspective on that, and do you think we have sufficient capacity to identify when somebody either makes a wrong decision or is a bad actor?
Well, it's the problem is it's across the board. Yes, we have several correctional officers that have been caught bringing in contraband. In my experience, it's primarily, I wouldn't even say a core group of inmates. It's like all inmates try to bring in contraband, okay? We have some safeguards in place. You know, we have a detection canine, body scanners, but the type of contraband that's coming in the most now is Suboxone. It is very small, it is hard to detect, and the inmates are two steps ahead of us at all times in finding it. So it's frustrating. There's no one simple solution. I guess we're fortunate that Suboxone is something that they can't overdose on, really. I don't have one answer for it. I'd like to see more effective body scanners possibly for remands, because that is the primary method of contraband coming in. And, you know, better opportunities for the inmates to get help for their addictions. I mean, it's really, really bad amongst a lot of them.
So my intention, Mr. Knapp, was not necessarily to put the corrections officers in a bad light. I was just wondering if the tools for anybody who is found out to be a bad actor is sufficient, maybe even within the Police Standards Council. For me, and I hope you would pass this along, we depend upon the corrections officers day in and day out. They're probably the unseen heroes in many ways of the world of policing. Because they have 24/7 watch that they have to continually watch. So I did not mean to say anything other than are our rules sufficient to deal with those people who have found either to make a bad decision or really become bad actors?
I believe so.
All right.
There's no reason for people to bring contraband in for prisoners.
Yeah, and so we were entertained and informed the other day by the commissioner on a Norway model that talked about upping the level of credibility and respect for corrections officers and corrections generally. Some of it's going to be corrections industries, and so I'd say just watch the world. We're trying to figure out how to raise the level of the noble work and make our corrections a little more productive all along the way. But for what you work in the Police Standards Council, making sure that our officers at the corrections officers' place have a good understanding of the standards and are part of the discussion on those standards. So is there any other questions at this point? Sorry for being so long on the comment, but I just wanted you to know how much we appreciate the day-in and day-out work and what you can bring to the table to this council.
Thank you.
And with that, we do have one other person, Craig Mitchell, who will be showing up in our committee today, but he is actually in a job interview as we speak. So I told him he could call in, and so before I make this appointee report passed out, we'll kind of watch to see him come in. So thanks to Mr. Nicholson, Chief Dahl, and Mr. Knapp. If you want, I can go ahead and leave you to your work, and thank you very much for being in front of us. I see no further questions, but I intend to pass this sheet out and have everybody agree to pass you on to the full body for recommendations. With that, so while we wait for Michael Craig from for the Police Standards Council, will set aside the testimony for that right now. And so my intention right now is to bring up the Senate Bill 175 for public testimony. And at this point, I have before I get to that, we'll welcome Senator Wilkowski. Senator Wilkowski, just to explain what we've been doing the last little bit, we've taken testimony from three of the four members of the Police Standards Council. We have one member that will be calling in shortly. I understand that he is in a job interview, so he will call when he is available. At this point, I was going to bring up Senate Bill 175, which is the Department of Natural Resources disclosure of confidential information and open up public testimony. And for your information, we do have Attorney General's office online, Peter Caligorian. I think I said that improperly, but Peter, excuse me. We also have Rebecca Cruz with the Department of Natural Resources. We have Tim, is it Bassion, with the Division of Natural Resources for questions. At this point, I have, and I also have James Beckham, who is here for questions with the Deputy Director. He's Deputy Director of Division of Oil and Gas. I did have one person to testify, and then maybe if there's questions, we could bring them up. But I just wanted to, I didn't allow for public testimony last time. We just laid it out for introduction. And at this point, if the committee has any questions, you can ponder that. But right now I have Kara Moriarty, who is with the Alaska Oil and Gas Association in Anchorage, who is willing to give some public testimony. So, Kara, welcome to our committee, and put yourself on the record and give us testimony on this Senate Bill 175.
Chairman Cocktail, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you now. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Thank you. Chairman Cocktail, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present our concerns with Senate Bill 175. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, commonly referred to as AOGA. AOGA is a private trade association, and we represent the majority of oil and gas producers, explorers, refiners, and transporters of Alaska's oil and gas, and my brief comments today reflect the views of our membership. While AOGA recognizes the administration's efforts to address potential issues surrounding royalty audits and appeals, AOGA doesn't currently support Senate Bill 175 in its current form, and we have conveyed these concerns to the Department of Natural Resources. And we have two main concerns with the bill. First, we believe Senate Bill 175 should add language that exempts royalty settlement agreements, commonly referred to as RSAs, from the provisions of the bill, because we see these agreements as contractual agreements between the state and a company that vary based on terms of the agreement. And further, royalty settlement agreements often contain certain legal restrictions already regarding the disclosure of confidential information to a party that's not part of the contractual agreement. And we wouldn't want what this bill is trying to do to disrupt what has already been agreed to as far as confidentiality is concerned and royalty settlement agreements. Secondly, our second concern is in regards to the individuals who will have access to this confidential information under a protective order during a royalty audit or appeal. And we would just like to see language that limits the release of confidential information to only those individuals who are directly involved with the royalty audit or appeal, just so that there are some sideboards and protections. We've tried to keep an open dialogue with DNR since they introduced this legislation, and we are trying to find some common ground, but right now, the way the bill is currently drafted, we can't support the current version, but we hope that we can work together to address the concerns that we've expressed today while still accomplishing what DNR is trying to achieve. So with that, I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I thank you for allowing me to call in today.
Thank you. Other questions for Kara Moriarty at this point for Eoga? Thank you, Kara, for calling in. We will get the Department of Natural Resources to give us some feedback on the if we can get to specific royalty agreements for only those involved, and we'll take a look at it. My intention today was mainly just to get on the record of that public testimony, and then I'll get DNR to come back before us to address some of those things. And we'll, in the meanwhile, we'll see if there's any ground. I know that the other body has done some work, which I've looked at. It doesn't look like it's going to be sufficient to work, so we're going to work on it. So, and that's both for you and DNR in our hearing. So, is there any other questions? There are those from DNR who have made themselves available, and I just wanted to see if there's any questions that you could bring up at this point. I'm going to lay the bill aside then, and we'll bring it back up, and we'll see if we can find a methodology that we can bring into a committee substitute. If not, I'll let you all know where we're at. We do have a new bill to discuss, so I'm going to lay aside that Senate Bill 175 and bring up Senate Bill 202, which has to do with the lack of evidence of liability of NATO corporations for the release of threatened release hazardous substance on certain lands. So Senator Hoffman's staff here today. Put yourself on the record. Give us your best introduction to the bill, and then we'll walk through it.
Okay. Thank you, sir, and members of the committee. And I apologize. Senator Hoffman did intend to be here today, and looks like he has been taken somewhere else. So this is Senate Bill 202, which provides relief. Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Meriden Borio, staff to Senator Hoffman. Senate Bill 202 provides relief from liability to Alaska Native corporations from damages and costs related to contaminated land conveyed to Native corporations through the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANCSA, if contamination is proved to have occurred prior to the transfer of the land. Signed into law in 1971, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act created 44 million acres of entitlement and directed the federal government, Bureau of Land Management, BLM, to convey the land to village and regional Native corporations. When the conveyances started to occur throughout the 1970s, the BLM was not required to disclose whether there had been existing contamination on the land. This problem started being noticed in the 1980s as more and more villages became aware of the inventory of what was on their lands. During the 1990s, concerns were raised that contaminated land was conveyed during this process. In 1998, a Department of Interior report to Congress on hazardous substance contamination of ANCSA lands confirmed the concerns and identified more than 650 contaminated sites requiring remediation. These sites were contaminated under ownership and or responsibility of the federal government and then transferred to Native ownership. A 2016 Bureau of Land Management update to the DOI report to Congress acknowledged that the agency had not acted on much of its 1998 report recommendations. It identified 537 sites that required remediation, 94 of which are not in a cleanup program, but the contamination was present at the time of the transfer. The BLM classifies these as orphan sites. Additionally, there are still over 100 sites that still require further verification and may be added to the orphan sites list. And I'll just note that both the 1998 and 2016 reports have been provided to you. Alaska Native corporations face potential legal exposure for the remediation of the contaminated lands conveyed under ANCSA. The intent of SB 202 is to provide a tool to help remedy this injustice by relieving the Alaska Native corporations from liability due to the occurrence of contamination on land conveyed to the Native corporations through ANCSA. And important to note that SB 202 is not advocating for any inclusion of protections for post-conveyance contamination. Thank you. That's introduction to that.
So a couple of questions. But before I do, questions from the committee? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get an idea what sort of problems exist out there and what. I saw one letter. There was some mercury issues, I think. I'm just trying to get a sense of what the scope of the problem is and what sort of contamination there is.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, there's all manner of contamination, I guess. Much of the land was Department of Defense property, so different kinds of chemicals associated with that endeavor, but mercury is one of them. Other words that I probably can't pronounce correctly, and I do have other folks online who can probably give you more detail of the chemicals, but quite a lot of chemicals that were stored, also federal aviation and the FAA property, so different oils and things of that nature, if that's helpful.
Yeah. And, but just for information, the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association is online. We got Hallie Bissett, so we'll bring her into the discussion shortly. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. That's helpful. And I'm also trying to understand, is there threats of lawsuits, or is this predominantly responsibility to the federal government to clean it up? And then I guess if we pass this, who would be responsible?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, yes, right now the Native corporations are liable, and they do face threats of lawsuits. A lot of these sites are very near to existing villages, so they could contaminate, you know, drinking water or other land that is being used. And what this is hoping, what this will do is relieve the liability from the Native Corporation, so they won't be responsible only if it's proven that was already existing contamination, and then they can go after, their primary thing is to pursue funding from the federal government to help clean it up, but yes, they would have to determine, also help in determining who may be responsible prior, who may have contaminated it prior, which in many cases is the federal government.
Senator Costello, you had a question as well.
Yes, thank you. My question is kind of along the same line. So the bill relieves liability to the Native corporations, but it's my understanding it doesn't specifically assign liability to the federal government, and that's just left unaddressed in the bill.
Senator Costello, through the chair, correct. It doesn't. It's not stating who's responsible. So right now, and I do believe Christian Ryan is online also from DEC. But right now, a lot of sites have been identified. This has been going on for a very long time, so they know. In some cases, who's responsible, and they've been cleaning it up. But yes, it doesn't assign any responsibility. It just says that if the contamination happened prior to the transfer of the land, that the Native corporations are not liable for that.
When the bill,
Senator Costello,
when the bill was drafted, did you contemplate going a step further to actually provide that liability, or direct it, or perhaps ask for a timetable?
Senator Costello, through the chair, not necessarily. So, we did get this language from the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association to align them with what they're trying to do with the federal government, which I believe has just happened in the recent spending bill. So we were happy with this language, if that answers your question.
Final question, Mr.
Chair. Sure. Senator Costello.
Is there any documentation that you're aware of that lists the contaminated sites and keeps log of what those are?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, yes. DEC does have a list of all the sites, I'm not sure federally, and I'm sure Holly can let you know, but yes, the state of Alaska keeps close track of them.
And you don't have DEC on the line, just to let you know.
I apologize.
So if we need to, we could probably get back to them. Senator Schauer?
Yes. Thank you. Just a little bit of a follow-up to Senator Costello's question. If I'd like to get access to that list and take a look at it. And the question being, is there anyone that if we go back in time that, for example, it was transferred from federal lands and maybe somebody either state or even a private entity, so that we would know, unless you can verify there wasn't? Because my question would become, it could be a big liability on a person from decades ago if we don't know, if we're not careful. So you might be able to answer that now, and if not, I'd like to get an answer to that to make sure we're not setting somebody up for failure with a what could be a very expensive lawsuit or cleanup.
Senator Schauer, through the chair, I will absolutely get you that link and the list. I do have a map that just kind of shows where contamination has occurred already, the sites that have been identified. That's from the DEC website. It's in your packet. But and those that are the orphan sites I mentioned. but certainly I will get the information that you need there.
So, Mayor Dunn, one question on the orphan site. I noticed they're the smaller number. Mm-hmm. That means there's probably well over 400 that are at least they're corralled and we know pretty much what's going on. Explain to me orphan site and how they're determined to be.
Senator Coghill, it's my understanding that the orphan sites basically don't have not been assigned a blame. And there's a definition. I can read you the definition from the report if you give me a, sorry, half a second here. I have it marked. But and I know that Holly can speak to that a little bit more clearly. Oops, I grabbed the wrong.
Okay. well, why don't I have Holly go ahead and give her testimony, and we can let you look at that. Why don't we do that and let you thumb through the paperwork so that we're not sitting here breathing over your shoulder on that. Holly, with the Alaska Native Corporation Association, welcome to our committee. Why don't you go ahead and give your testimony and maybe answer a few questions as well.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. For the record, my name is Holly Bissett. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association. We represent 176 Alaska Native villages that were created under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act that were actually transferred these lands under the 1971 Act. To answer a couple of questions, I heard, you know, just to give you an idea about the breadth of this problem, since I've been working on this problem, I've met a little old lady that has to bury her fish because, you know, there's a gel-like substance in the fish. They don't really know what it is, so they're just burying it and hoping they don't see it again. And after I gave my speech at ASN about the contaminated land issues we were working on, a guy came up to me afterward and said, hey, have you heard the word about the glowing fish?
Holly, can I stop you for a second?
Uh-huh.
Are you on a speakerphone, just out of curiosity?
No, sir, I'm not.
Okay, you might want to slow it down a little bit then, because it seems like we have a little bit of pushback in the link. However the link is, the last few sentences that you had were not very clear. So if you can go back to you represent X amount of communities and how that then you went into a specific example. So could you back up to that point for me, please?
Yes, so we represent 176 Alaska Native Village Corporations that were created under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, and we are the landowners of the contaminated land that you've been hearing about. And I was talking about specific examples of contamination that I've seen or heard about since I've been working on this project, and those include a glow-in-the-dark fish, a fish that are gel-like substance that they're having to bury. These sites are contaminated with PCBs. They're white alice sites. They're old flood sites for DOD, and I think Meriden did a great job of explaining the path of the issue, so I'm not going to go into all that. I'm definitely here to answer any questions you might have regarding this specific legislation. We're not trying to find blame. As Meriden stated, we are hopefully going to be cleaning these sites up. One of the things that we need is this legal liability shield, and the reason we need that is because we think there are more sites out there that we haven't qualified and quantified yet. We have identified over 600 sites that are either in a remediation program or not in a remediation program. 94 of the sites are what are called orphan sites. That means that they're not intending to clean them up at all, and almost all of those sites are within 2 miles of a village. And that's a big problem for us. So we are really hoping to compel the federal government or whoever was responsible for the prior contamination of these lands to clean them up in partnership with perhaps a local workforce.
Holly, I'm going to stop you there for a minute.
I'm done.
We do not have a very good connection. And we were able to generally catch everything you said, but there were a few details, I think, that didn't come across very clearly. So we got the need fairly clearly. Some of the substances you talked about we didn't get as clearly. And the fact that there are still searchings going on in some villages, it sounds to me like you still are yet identifying some contaminated sites. Is that, did I get that correctly?
Yes, sir, that is correct.
Okay. And I'm sorry, we just have a poor connection right now.
So, I apologize, too. I'm not sure what's wrong with my phone, sir.
Yeah. Do you have something that you can submit to us in writing that I can add to the record that might help that clarity?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Holly. I really appreciate that. It's just unfortunate in Alaska, every once in a while we get one of those links that just is not smooth for us. So
yeah, I'm very sorry.
So maybe back to Meridon, I can ask one question. How many sites to present have determined that either the state is responsible or it would end up being somehow falling upon the state to help clean up?
Senator Coghill, I don't know that number actually specifically for this state, and I'll get that to you
Sure. Because if we're going to excuse a responsibility, and if it's our responsibility, we should probably at least know about that. And if we would like to partner, I think it looks like anything, it would be from this bill forward or from the taking of the land forward, that if there was contamination, for example, if they set up a tank farm on the native land and they didn't manage it properly, that would have been on, that would be on them regardless of what this bill says. This bill would say on the taking of the land into our ownership, it was already determined, or we could already determine that it was contaminated. That's kind of what we're looking at, true?
Correct.
All right. So if the state has a responsibility, the state still has a responsibility.
Yeah, and Senator Coghill, I apologize that I did think DEC was there, and she probably knows that number right off the top of her head, but I'll make sure that they're available next time.
All right. Well, my intention would be to have this introduced to the committee, and then my intention is to move it on Wednesday. So if there are further questions that we need to ask to get answers to on Wednesday, we should bring them up, because I don't want to hold this bill up. It's fairly straightforward. I think two questions at this point have come up. So any other questions? Holly, since I cut you off because we had a poor connection, is there anything that you wanted to add that how you feel is important to put on the record?
No, Senator Coghill, I'll go ahead and submit in writing our testimony so you guys have that.
And that came very clear, so thank you.
That's funny because now you're on speakerphone.
Oh, man. Isn't that something how that works? Ay, ay, ay. The wonderful technology of our world. We do have Emily Nauman online, who is the legal drafter of this, just for this, the information of the committee. It seemed pretty straightforward, why don't you just take us right through the language of the bill real quickly, just to give us how to get into the actual language of the bill, Meridon, and I'd appreciate that. Thank you very
okay.
much.
Okay. Sure, Senator. Section 1 adds the subsection N, which is the language that relieves the Native Corporation from liability if the Native Corporation can prove the hazardous materials were already present on the land before the land was transferred to the Native Corporation under ANCSA. Section 2 amends 4603.822M to add a new paragraph that defines Native corporation to have the same meaning as in federal law under United States Code 1602M, and that's the ANCSA statute. And that definition is Native corporation means any regional corporation, any village corporation, any urban corporation, and any group corporation. Section 3 is the new language that I referenced above, adds the new subsection N that relieves Native corporations from liability if the Native corporation can prove the hazardous materials were already present on the land before the land was transferred to the Native corporation under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
And, Mayor Dunn, there, Section 4 is a repealer. Can you explain to the repealer to us, as you say?
Yes, sir. And I did provide this time, Senator Coghill, in your packet, a better explanation from Emily and Ledge Legal. Currently provided in statute, a Native corporation must prove that, one, the release or threatened release occurred only because of an act of God or war, or the intentional or negligent act or omission of a third party. Two, if the release or threatened release occurred only because of the intentional or negligent act or omission of a third party, the corporation acted with care and took reasonable precautions to prevent the release or threatened release. And three, that if the release or threatened release occurred only because of the intentional or negligent act or omission of a third party within a reasonable time frame after the act causing the release or threatened release, the corporation discovered the release or threatened release and began cleanup or to contain it. And this just does boils it down a little bit clearer and less onus, I guess, act of war and all those things to say the release or threatened release of a hazardous substance is on ANCSA land and the hazardous substance was present on the land at the time of the land when it was transferred to the Native corporation. And I hope that's a better.
So the various different words in those three categories were just easier explained in this. I can see where you would have to navigate through that probably as a legal matter. So, other questions at this point on this particular bill, Senator Wilkowski.
So, does this apply to strict liability or negligence? Looking at Section 1, it looks like it's strict liability, but could you know the answer to that?
Senator Wilkowski, if you don't mind, I could have Emily do that as she is our legal.
Emily, did you hear the question? Emily Nauman, did you hear the question?
I did, yes.
Okay, thank you for go ahead and put yourself on the record and give an answer to that, please. Thank you.
Sure. For the record, this is Emily Nauman with Legislative Legal Services. The question I heard is whether or not this is a waiver of strict liability. Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, yes, this is just a waiver of strict liability.
So, Senator Wilkowski on that?
So a Native corporation could be sued under negligence. Would Section 3 of this bill apply to a negligence lawsuit, or does that just apply to a strict liability lawsuit?
Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, yes, you're right that there are alternate legal methods through which a Native corporation could be found liable for costs related to spills on land owned by the Native corporation. Negligence is one possible way that might happen.
So, Senator Wilkowski.
So, I want to make sure I understand this. So, under current law, if there's some contaminants on a piece of Native corporation land, they leak into somebody's well, let's say, and that they would be strictly liable. Under this law, the way we're changing it is to say no longer strictly liable as long as they can prove that the substance was there before the lands were granted to them under ANCSA. Is that correct?
To the chair, to Senator Wilkowski, In part. I would point out that under the current law, as Meriden explained, there is an exception for a native corporation if, as she pointed out in my memo, the native corporation has taken certain steps to clean up and to monitor the situation. But yes, there are other ways through which a native corporation can be found liable even after or assuming this bill becomes law.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. And so you could file like a nuisance claim or a trespass claim or a negligence claim, and they would not be exempted from those lawsuits?
That's correct. Through the chair.
And then
Senator Wilkowski.
So is there what would happen on non-native corporation land if there was pollution that existed prior to the conveyance on statehood? I assume the owner would just be responsible for it? A non-corporation strictly responsible?
Through the chair, just excuse me for 1 second. I'm looking up 4603.822, which puts the burden of responsibility on a sort of a series of different parties. So under 4603.822A1, it's the owner or person having control of the hazardous substance, or the owner or operator of a vessel or facility from which the substance was released. Three, a person who's responsible for the disposal of the substance, or a person who has a contract or agreement to arrange for the treatment or disposal or transport of the substance. You know, there's a couple more, all laid out in 4603.822A.
And just for the members' information and for those listening in, this is N in a series of A through N responsibility factors. So, Senator Wilkowski.
So if we pass this law, then let's say there's some toxins on a native corporation land. We're saying they're not strictly liable, but who would be responsible? Would the state be responsible at that point, or the federal government, or what?
Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, I imagine that would be a highly fact-dependent action. We might look to who owns the hazardous substance or who owned it previously. It's really difficult to say without knowing how the hazardous substance ended up there or who was responsible for its release.
Senator Wilkowski, to continue.
Yeah, I mean, I assume that under Section 3 we're saying that the native corporation has to prove the substance was present on the land at the time the land was granted. So would that put the liability on the federal government?
I don't think, through the chair, excuse me, Senator Wilkowski, I don't think that this bill changes the liability with respect to the federal government. It only changes the liability with respect to the native corporation. So to the extent that the federal government could be found liable now for that type of action, this bill wouldn't change that.
So my expectation is when selections were given to the state may have acted on that selection only to find out that it was conveyed under Native Claim Settlement Act. So there could be some responsibility there, and then they would have to probably duke it out to figure out who really was the landowner at that time of contamination, if I understand correctly, Emily.
To the chair, yes, that's my understanding.
All right. Any other questions at this point?
Well, just
Senator Wilkowski.
Let's say you've got toxins on a land, and the native corporation is now exempt from responsibility. Would the state be obligated to clean it up?
through the chair to Senator Wilikowski. Sorry, this is Emily Nauman again with Legislative Legal Services. You know, I don't know the answer off the top of my head. I understand that Kristen Ryan is also on the phone, and I believe that I've heard her answer similar questions before, so she might be able to give you a more accurate answer.
And I'm sorry to say that Kristen Ryan is not on the phone right now.
I apologize.
So we will hold that question over till Wednesday, and we'll bring that up. Senator Wilikowski, can I depend upon you to bring that question back up on
sure.
Wednesday?
Yes.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Wilikowski, if I might, the intent of the Native Corporations is not to not clean it up. In fact, they want to identify it. They want to clean it up on their land, and especially get the funding through the federal government. So I don't know if that helps. It's not they want to know who was responsible for it beforehand if it wasn't them, but then they can apply for all manner of funding. And I know that doesn't specifically answer your question, but
I think you made that intent pretty clear, and then we're just trying to figure out who bears the ultimate responsibility.
And just
Senator Wilikowski.
On that, because I read those comments in some of the letters, and I'm trying to understand how that works. You're more likely to get federal funding if you're not liable. Is that?
I believe so, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, but I absolutely will try to boil this down and get you the information. More precisely.
And that is a key question, since that's a key element of the reasoning why. And so, Maradona, I would depend upon you to bring that information before us on Wednesday.
Yes, sir.
And maybe we'll make sure that Kristen gets online. And we'll try to deal with it early on
okay.
in the meeting on Wednesday so that we can dispatch this thing if we're satisfied. All right?
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Any other questions at this point before we go? All right, thank you very much. So with that, we'll set Senate Bill 202 aside with the idea that we'll bring it up on Wednesday. One other bill that I had in mind, and I just wanted to see if I could get the members to take a look at it. It was House Bill number 43, which Jason Grin, Representative Grin, brought forward, and it was on the right to try new drugs for the terminally ill. We, in previous legislators, we have actually heard this. This is Jason Grin's attempt, Representative Grin's attempt to bring it up. It goes from here to the Rules Committee. So has anybody had a chance to look at it critically enough to have questions at this point? After its first introduction, because all I did was allow for introduction. I can ask the staff to come up for questions if you want to. It would be my intention to move it up to rules, unless you have some concerns. So with that, then, I did bring the folder down with me, so Senator Costello, could you make a move to move the CS for House Bill number 43 from committee?
I move CS for House Bill number 43, Judiciary Version Juliet, from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Any objection to moving it from committee, committee members? So with that, we will move the bill CS for House Bill 43 from committee with individual recommendations, and I will have Jordan bring the signing sheet around in a moment. Before we do that, though, I do have Mike Craig, who is with the Alaska Police Standards Council, who's online. He joined us just a few moments ago, and I thought maybe we'd go ahead and go through his introduction and any questions that you want to ask him before we adjourn the committee. Mr. Craig, thank you for joining us. Put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. I appreciate the adjustment in the time, because I remember Jordan had initially asked me to be available at 1:30, so I do appreciate the allowance for the change in time. I've not gone through this before, so you're looking for just kind of who I am and you know, where I've been and what I do, that sort of thing.
Mike, why don't you what you do, why you would enjoy working on the Police Standards Council, what you bring to the table, and if you've already attended some meetings, what your observations are.
Oh, that'd be great. So I am with the Alaska Pipeline Service Company as a employee concerns coordinator, essentially working in the business practice office, also looking into conduct kind of things with regards to Alaska employees and or contractor employees on the pipeline. I've been doing that for about 2 years or so. Previous to that, I was on the corporate security team for the past 33 years. So I've been on the pipeline for quite a long time. When I was first asked if I would look into or consider joining the Alaska Police Standards Council back in 2017 to replace Mr. Burton, Richard Burton, who was departing, just kind of finish out his tenure, I honestly didn't know, you know, what the Alaska Police Standards Council was about. So I did some research, looked on their website at their charter. I attended a meeting just as a public member just to see, you know, kind of what it looked like. And it turned out to be a really good meeting to attend because I didn't realize, you know, how much of it would go to executive session. So we got in. I was able to listen to some of the meeting process. And then when they went to executive session, I got to just listen, kind of talk to the various people in the room. There was policemen, firemen, various kinds of different people from the public, and ask them about their perception of what the Police Standards Council was. And it was really enlightening. And then Mr. Griffiths actually had to recuse himself for some reason or another. So he ended up in the room and got a chance to talk to him, about, you know, the entire process, and was pretty intrigued by it. And at that time, thought, yes, this is something that I would like to do. And I've been to, so I finished off the meetings in 2017. I think I attended two or three. And then in 2018, I've attended one since. And I really like the process. What I have found with the individuals that are on that committee is they are fully invested in the depth of what we're considering. I mean, these are people's lives. It's not just, you know, the certifications for whether they're going to be in law enforcement or not. There's so much more to it. And it was pretty easy to kind of get a feel for how much everybody appreciates what their role is. And so for me, as the public member, without having been previous law enforcement in any way, although I have worked with law enforcement folks over the 30-some years of my career in security on the pipeline, it was really I think it's important to bring that public kind of, you know, questioning to the process, because a lot of the people on that are either chiefs of police or sergeants or in some level of, you know, law enforcement management. So I've really enjoyed, you know, listening to the process. I have absolutely no qualms with inserting, you know, a contrary opinion if that's, you know, the case. And or as far as the voting goes, I feel very strongly that I'm going to vote, you know, from the public perspective with the information that's provided. And I don't feel swayed, you know, by, you know, the kind of the larger group's intent if that's not where I'm going to land.
Thank you. I appreciate that willingness to be thoughtful and independent and participate in the Police Standards Council and being willing to learn, because it's definitely a learning experience. Is there questions for Mr. Craig? Mr. Craig, I understand that we interrupted your life. Thanks for joining us. All I'm going to say is thank you for being willing to serve in this capacity. And it sounds like the voice you bring will be thoughtful and deliberate. So thank you very much.
And I appreciate the opportunity as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we'll conclude the Senate Judiciary Committee today. Thank you for your attention. With that, we will adjourn the meeting. It looks like it's 2:38. So I take that back. We're not adjourned. The Senate Judiciary Committee forgot to put on the record a statement regarding the appointees for the Police Standards Council. So in accordance with the Alaska Statute 3905.080, The Judiciary Committee reviewed the following and recommends appointment before to the joint session. That is Justin Dahl of Anchorage, Larry Nicholson of Kodiak, Michael Craig of Anchorage, David Knapp of Palmer for the Police Standards Council of Alaska. And all members have signed the committee report. With that, we'll be adjourned.